Today, you're in treat because we have someone who is very esteemed, and we are going to find out what exactly is going to happen to the economy, your money, your future, your children, your grandchildren's, and is the esteemed David M. Walker, who is a former U.S. Comptroller for the United States of America, was initially appointed under Reagan, then Clinton, has served and internationally recognized as one of the men who understands the way money works, how to do it responsibly, and how to transform government, if that's even a real thing. It sounds good on paper, but does it actually work in actuality? David M. Walker, welcome to the show. How are you?
JT, it's a pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
So I'm going to ask you a question. So when I saw that your sort of niche, right, is fiscal responsibility. Before we go into the background, everything. With trillions of dollars being added to the debt almost on a monthly basis, are we being fiscally responsible? Because the idea of printing money seems to be something that our country and countries all over the world seem to be very comfortable about.
Absolutely not. The last fiscally responsible president of the United States was Bill Clinton. The last time that we worked on a bipartisan basis to try to make some tough choices on fiscal issues was when Clinton was president and Newt Gingrich was Speaker of the House. They worked together to try to achieve welfare reform and certain other reforms. I was Comptroller General of the United States, which in English is Auditor General, Chief Accountability Officer, and CEO of the Government Accountability Office from 98 to 2008. The first 4 years, we had surpluses. 2 years, we paid down debt, and things spun out of control starting in 2003, which I'm happy to get into. So the answer is absolutely not. There's not a party of fiscal responsibility. And we haven't had a fiscally responsible president since Clinton.
So you have a book that's coming out, which basically whether or not America will still be a superpower. We have an audience, global audience, listening to this show, literally people from all over the world. And it used to be, and I'm originally from Canada. So I looked up, you know, I always tell people I was born in Canada, made in America. And now I travel all around the world. And, you know, no one really idolizes America like did before. It's very divided from movements to division, you know, with Trump to Biden muffling lines to, you know, on one side, Israel, Gaza, Russia, Ukraine, and then you have obviously China, who is basically aligning himself. So you have BRICS that has now arise where, you know, how much of that was because Biden was there or that's something that was moved into. So is America a superpower where did we go wrong?
Well, first, America is a superpower. Let me define what I believe a superpower to be. It's a country that has global economic power, global diplomatic influence, global military capabilities, and global cultural influence. And the truth is, after World War II, we were the only country that met all four of those criteria. The Soviet Union was not a global economic power. It did not have global cultural influence. But the fact is that our market share has declined dramatically with regard to percentage of global GDP. We now face a rising China who does meet the criteria and has high ambitions. We face a realignment of alliances around the world. You have China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and a few other countries that are aligned against the U.S. interest economically, diplomatically, militarily, and culturally. And the bottom line answer to the book, and the book is entitled America in 2040, Still a Superpower? The answer is yes, if we do the things that are outlined in the book, to put our finances in order and write a number of policies. And the answer is no, if we don't. We are in decline right now. We're still a superpower. We're still a great country. Our future can be better than our past, but we're on the wrong track in too many areas, and that has to change.
So you're an old school, no BS type of guy. You can definitely tell by this. What is your take on the changing country of wokeness, of just all these things in the past few years that is dividing the country, not unifying the country? And so on one hand, you have this, but then on the other side, you have stock market at an all-time high. Bitcoin is, you know, 66,000, and people listen to this maybe higher by the time they listen or lower. And you have like polarization like we've never seen before. We have immense, massive debt. So you decide you're anointed president, you're elected president. can you even change all this, or the ship has sailed? Because people have to admit they're wrong. And in my experience, I don't think, you know, COVID was a perfect example. A lot of mistakes were made, transparency, silencing voices, just in general, right? Just basically made, and no one's come up and say, you know what, we did it wrong. Here's how we're going to make sure, because there's only one thing being worse than wrong, which is dead wrong. And if you admit you're wrong, it'll be used against you. So let me ask you, can this even all be fixed? I know it's solution in the book, but realistically speaking, is the ship has sailed?
No, the ship has not sailed, but it's taking on water, and we need to save the USS America. The bottom line is this: the most powerful words in the Constitution are the first three words, we the people. The people are a lot smarter than the politicians realize. They understand that you can't continue to spend a lot more money than you make, charge it to the credit card without having a day of reckoning. By the way, the number one factor on the way up to become a superpower and the number one factor on the way to go down is economic power. And if you can't put your finances in order, you will not maintain economic power. You'll lose diplomatic influence. You'll lose the ability to fund a strong military. You'll lose your cultural identity, if you will. And so we've got to put our finances in order. I have done citizen education and engagement efforts in 47 states, two U.S. territories, and D.C. And in doing that, I've gotten 77 to 97% agreement on specific reforms to taxes, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, defense, political reforms, et cetera. You have to start with the people. Yes, the politicians have to vote because we have a republic, but the people need to push the politicians. And if they do, we can defuse this ticking debt bomb. And I'm committed to do it.
So when I first came to America, which is about 13 years ago, you know, I love America, an American citizen now. And, you know, I respect our militaries. I realize the sacrifice that they make, you know, being away 9 months out of the year, sometimes longer, you know, putting their lives on the line for very little pay so that we can enjoy the very freedoms that we now have, that I have today, and that many people watching this, and this doesn't apply to America, all over the world, but it just seems the respect, you know, of today, like I think what you're 72 years old is something like that, right? And so I look at this as an honor and a respect of wisdom of people who have been there, who have paved the way. I feel the respect is not there. How can you change if there's not respect for the office of the presidency? It's okay, I don't like this person, not a fan of this person, but I respect the office of the presidency, he's my leader. You know, the military, it just, there's nothing seem to be a respect these days because there's a sense of entitlement. And I think that's why a lot of the mistakes is nobody wants to listen to anyone, and it's nobody else's fault. Everybody wants to kick the can down the road. I mean, from a standpoint, it just seems that the world is a bit upside down right now.
We're very divided, and it's not really a partisan divide, although that's a problem. I think the biggest divide that we have in the United States right now is what I would call an ideological divide. Are we going to be committed to the principles and values under which this country was founded and that made us great? Such things as limited but effective government, individual liberty and opportunity, personal responsibility and accountability, rule of law and equal justice under the law, fiscal responsibility, intergenerational equity, and stewardship. Those were our founding principles. They made us great. We've strayed. Or are we going to adopt socialist state principles, which is grow government, increase dependency on government, take control of healthcare, take control of education, don't worry about deficits and debt, and live for today without helping to try to create a better tomorrow? That is the real battle. The truth is today, confidence in government is at or near an all-time low.
Trust in the government is at a total.
Trust in the government is an all-time low. You know, the confidence in the president is low. He's generally viewed as being weak and woke, and that's not a good combination.
People would rather have him. They'd be like Mark Cuban says, said this today, that if he was on a respirator, he'd still vote for Biden because that was better than Trump. I mean, and I think a lot of people have that similar feeling. And then other people will be like, you know, I come back as the way the news channels work, right? So if you're a Fox News type of person, you listen to it and you indoctrinate yourself because that's what you believe. And the other side, and then same thing with MSNBC and all those other networks, nobody wants to listen to the other sides of issues because it's going to infuriate them too much. You know, you and I are very much in the middle. I have views on both sides, but I'm not a person, if this person says everything, I'm going to believe everything. And I think it's this cult or herd mentality that we have here today. And everyone believes in the freedom of speech as long as you agree with them. And that's the problem, is there needs to be like, you know, I know Democrats, I've never said like, I'm not going to do business because you're a Democrat, or I'm not going to do business because you're Trump. Like, I would never do that. I have a lot of businesses. It doesn't make any sense. And now these days, there are people who will cancel you because of what you believe. That's not America. And the rest of the world are very much inclusive in other places. And I think we've kind of lost our way in there. So I just don't know how you can expect, especially the younger generation. You know, you're 72. I'm in the middle of that. Where's the, like, you got to get in the generations to buy in. But the problem is that the parents are indoctrinating their views to the kids, right? You have the teachers, depending on where you are indoctrinating their views. So by the time they're 18, and then I'm sure you know this, Ivy League schools are indoctrinating with this. So, you know what I mean? So for you, it's a logical sense, but I don't think the tools are there.
Well, to do that. First, it starts at home with the family. There's no question about that. And secondly, with regard to government, it starts at the top. We only have one person that's elected by all the people, and that's the president of the United States. The president's the only person that has the so-called bully pulpit that can end up trying to help articulate directly the American people and bring people together rather than divide them apart. Right now, we have a big election in 2024. 69% of voters don't want Biden. 62% of voters don't want Trump. I'm one of the national co-founders of No Labels. We may offer a third option for president and vice president. We're going to make a decision on that within the next several weeks.
Will that even be worked though? Like, it's never worked. I mean, Ross Perot may be the closest one, but is that taking a vote from one of the sides, which makes the other win? It sounds good.
Hold on. Ross Perot was a friend of mine. Okay. Ross Perot did not want to be president. He wanted to wake America up on two issues, fiscal responsibility, which we've touched on. And obviously we temporarily found our way and we really lost it now, and trade with regard to NAFTA. He had a major impact on Clinton and the Republicans, even though he didn't get a single electoral vote. But here's what's different. Today, the American people do not want a rematch of Biden versus Trump for very different reasons. They're very different human beings, okay? Secondly, we now have almost 50% of registered voters in the United States are unaffiliated or independent, as I am. We have at or near an all-time low of confidence in government. For the first time ever, a supermajority of Americans believe that life for their children and grandchildren won't be as good as theirs. And we've done extensive polling that shows that with the right ticket, there is a pathway to victory in the Electoral College. And as you know, when you have a three-way race, you just need a plurality, not a majority. We won't run the ticket unless we believe there's a pathway to victory in the Electoral College. But as of today, and I got briefed on this 2 days ago, there is. So we'll see.
By the way, Dave, I'm sorry. I was born in Canada. I can't be president. It would be an honor. I do a great job. Maybe I could be VP.
You probably would. Definitely better than these two guys.
Anybody at this point. Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Why in the school education, you know, you're a former comptroller of the United States, which is about fiscal responsibility. Why in the school system has they never just had a class on basic accounting, budgets and balances and spending? You know, like that seems to be, if you start with the fundamentals young, right, that maybe someone would have better understanding of that. Why do you think that's still not the case? Which, well, first, you have to admit it'd be important.
Well, first, I was a professor at the United States Naval Academy, so I've got some experience teaching as well. But the bottom line is I've been a longstanding advocate for mandatory financial literacy and civic responsibility training before you can graduate from high school. And I think one of the reasons that we're so dysfunctional is because people don't know how to manage their own finances. In addition, they don't understand what their role is in this republic, in this great country. And I think we need to have both of those things done. Right now, only 14 out of 50 states require financial literacy training before you graduate from high school. There's another 12 that are on the way to require it, but it should be 50 plus DC.
Let's take it back about what your job was. I don't know most, probably 99% probably. I mean, I think they're aware of a comptroller, but they don't really know. What does a comptroller do? What did you do? What does your day-to-day look like? Give us in a day-to-day, what did you do?
Well, first, my job was the Comptroller General of the United States, which in English is Auditor General, Chief Accountability Officer, Chief Executive Officer of the U.S. Government Accountability Office. GAO is in the legislative branch. It helps the Congress oversee the executive branch with regard to economy, efficiency, effectiveness. We did financial audits. We did performance audits. We did program evaluations. We did a policy analysis. We did legal research, adjudications. Basically, it was a very diversified consulting firm that happens to be a wholly owned subsidiary of the U.S. government. One of the things that I did, which is important, JT, is I'm a big believer in practicing what you preach and leading by example. I believe that government's grown too big, promised too much, subsidized too many, and needs to be dramatically transformed. Again, going back to the idea of limited but effective government at the federal level. So I transformed the GAO. I made it 13% smaller, eliminated a layer of government, consolidated a bunch of units, increased productivity by over 50%, increased return on tripled return on investment, made it the second best place to work in the federal government, and a 95% positive rating for the most difficult client on the face of the earth, which is called the U.S. Congress.
So it sounds like you very much ran it like a CEO of a company, right? If I was talking to a CEO of a company, it sounded like people thought when Trump first came in that being a businessman as the president would make sense. We'd run the country like a business. I think after 4 years, we found out that it doesn't really work that way because you need Congress and you need this and you need everybody's approval. So can the United States should be run like a business be make like, because it's not, I mean, we're effectively.
It's not a business, but there are certain business principles that should be applied to government. I mean, government, the culture in government is get the money, spend the money. The culture in government is the more money you have, the more people you have, then the better off you are. We don't link resources to results. Believe it or not, the federal government consolidated does not have a strategic plan that focuses on those four elements of maintaining our superpower status. China's got one. We don't have one. And without that, you really don't know whether or not you're making the progress that you need to make in order to help create a better future. Look, it's easier to measure in the private sector. You've got market share, you got gross margin, you've got net income, EBTI, shareholder value. You've got a number of things you can put a number on. But there are a number of basic principles that are transferable to the government. And what we did, and I say we, I was the leader, but we did at GAO is transferable and scalable to the rest of the government. But you have to have a president who's willing to do it. Understand this. The people who are the top people in government are presidential appointees, Senate confirmation. I've had three of them, Reagan, Bush, and Clinton. And I've had positions in every administration since the 80s, except for one. And I was offered one in that. You know, the typical presidential appointee with Senate confirmation is only in their job 2 or 3 years. You know, they're the temporary help. And if people don't like them, they just wait them out. But the other problem with that is that they don't have time to make the big transformational changes that we did at GAO. I had a 15-year term. I ended up staying 9.5 for a variety of reasons, but it takes time. You know how it is. Even in the private sector, if you want to make a major transformational change, it takes several years.
And
the key is not just to make it, but to do it in a way that it's sustained after you leave. And I'm proud and pleased to say the GAO has.
Did you report directly to the president or the chief of staff?
I reported to the Congress because GAO is in the legislative branch. And therefore, de facto, I reported to the leaders of the Congress and then the leaders of the two committees that oversee GAO. And of course, you always have to be concerned with the appropriators because they control your budget, right? So if you don't keep the appropriators happy, you're going to be in trouble.
Do you feel that sometimes you do all this stuff, you have all these great ideas and you're in the trenches and then you go to, Congress and a legislative body and it sounds like wah, 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 because they're just, some aide read the thing and probably gave him a paragraph. So is that frustrating? Knowing you have ideas or change can be done, but you're not getting.
Well, first, the GAO was really focused on operations. economy, efficiency, effectiveness. And we generated over $100 return for every dollar invested in the agency based upon recommendations that we made that were implemented and how much benefit resulted from that. We also helped achieve things like safety, security, privacy, which you can't put a dollar value on, but are real. What we weren't allowed to do, and the reason that I left GA early, is we weren't allowed to make policy recommendations. What do we need to do in tax policy? What do we need to do on the social insurance programs? What do we need to do with regard to healthcare? What do we need to do with regard to immigration, defense policy? We weren't allowed to do that. And my view is, in order to solve our problem, in order to right the ship, in order to help make sure that our future is better than our past, you have to get into those issues. And that's why I left, was CEO of the Peter G. Peterson Foundation. You may know who Pete was, Commerce Secretary, one of the founders of Blackstone, among other things. And I continue to fight today, not for me, but for my country, my children, and my grandchildren.
Did you ever go into the White Office, the Oval Office of the United
States? Oh, yeah, I've been in the Oval Office, but I don't work for the president. I have to be independent from the executive branch. Because again, we are the independent overseers working for the Congress and the American people, I might add.
Explain the first time you went to the White House, and what was that like in terms of nervousness? I mean, it's an honor, obviously, to go in, anytime to be in that, just try and get a frame of mind.
Well, the first time I went to the White House, I actually was not with GAO. I was in the Reagan administration. I was Assistant Secretary of Labor for ERISA, the Employer Retirement Income Security Act, which is pensions and health care. And Reagan was president, and I have great respect for Reagan. I think he was a great president for a number of different reasons. And so I went in for a meeting with President Reagan in the Oval Office. But again, I was part of his administration.
Right.
So
but still, how was it? Had you met him before that, or is it just like?
I had met him, but not in a meeting.
How does it work when you have a meeting? You're sitting down. Give me is it on the clock? Everybody's there. Is the president's schedule like my schedule, or is it just more loose? And how's it work?
Well, the president has a tight schedule. And of course, there are differences between presidents. Some presidents work a lot harder and longer than others do. We'll just kind of leave it at that. But you normally have a set amount of time that you're supposed to be in there. And they obviously have people that are watching the clock to try to make sure that, you stay on time, because normally they're pretty much booked constantly during the daytime.
And sitting down there, do you feel like nervous or empowered, or like thinking like, wow, like look where I started?
I feel honored.
And did that?
I don't get nervous. I've done over 300 hearings in Congress. I may have the all-time record.
Oh, wow.
I also had the unfortunate need to sue the Vice President of the United States when he did not cooperate with one of our audits and investigations. And that particular vice president was known for shooting his lawyer in the face with a shotgun. So, it was an accident. Okay. But right. In any event,
I think we're talking about Dick Cheney, right?
Yeah, that's right. So, I've got a thick skin. And when you're the auditor general, you better have a thick skin. But at the same point in time, I'm an equal opportunity complimenter and critiquer, truly an independent, tell it like it is, truth, transparency, and transformation.
I'm very much like that as well too, but it does backfire sometimes. People who like, they want you the truth and you tell them the truth, whether it's not a good idea, it's not a good business, or don't do that. And then I find people are very in love with their own ideas, and they're not open to hearing other positions that, or maybe they just took a part of it too. I feel like people have a very closed mindset when it comes to the no BS part. I don't know. What did you feel that you got like ostracized or attacked or because of that?
No. As long as you're telling the truth in a professional, objective, fact-based, nonpartisan, non-ideological, and non-personal manner, people will treat you with respect. Of all the hearings that I did, I only had really one hearing that I can think of that was somewhat contentious. But it ended up okay. I will tell you this, change is difficult, especially in government. It's much more difficult in government because it's monopoly. It doesn't face competition because you have people that are risk averse. Because, as you know, change starts at the top, starts with the new people, works to the middle. The toughest part is people that are close to retirement. But the other thing you need to keep in mind is something you said. It needs to be their idea, right?
Yeah, at 100%.
And one of the problems with the so-called Simpson-Bowles commission and other commissions is they try to come up with what the answers are and then sell the American people on it, right? But the problem is that the public doesn't have confidence in the government right now, those in the government. And so what you have to do is you have to start with the people, give them the facts, give them the truth, talk about the tough choices, solicit their input. And then after you do that, then you end up making recommendations because you're tilling the ground and preparing the way for tough choices. And then the members of Congress will feel that they have more of an ability to make those changes without losing their job. Simpson-Bowles did good work as an example, but they made a mistake of putting their name on their recommendations. You never want to do that. When I did the 10,000-mile tour in 2012, my name wasn't anywhere on the bus. It was about the issues. It was about the need for reform. It wasn't about any particular individual. And that's key, especially in politics.
Did you leave after politics to perhaps go into the business sector? Because I think you'd been a very good businessman, but principles apply the same. Then you have more flexibility to do that. Was that an ever interest of yours? And did you ever do
Well,
it?
I started out in business. I'm a CPA by training. I was in audit. I was in tax. I was in consulting. I was a global partner with Arthur Andersen. I ran their human capital strategy practice globally. After I ended up coming out of government, I ended up being a strategic advisor to PricewaterhouseCoopers, public sector, now known as Guidehouse, which is a very large consulting firm. I've actually spent more than half my life in the private sector. And I've had the good fortune of being able to lead organizations in the private sector, the public sector, and the not-for-profit sector. And not many people can say that. So I consider myself very lucky.
Did you prefer government or business? I know serving the country, forget serving the country, the honor. If you had to, like, would I rather be in business or I'd rather be a government official?
I enjoyed public service. I enjoyed every job that I've had, and I'm fortunate I've done well in every
But that
job that
doesn't
I've had.
pay very well, though.
Well, there's the difference. You can't take money with you.
That's
I
true.
will tell you. I will tell you that I learned from my parents. You plan, you save, you invest, you preserve, you get out of debt as quickly as possible. I followed all that advice. I'll never be wealthy, but I'm well off. Okay, and I don't have to
Your
worry about.
house appreciated, I'm sure, where you live. So probably worth way more than what it was before. That alone is probably your best asset.
Not in Connecticut, my friend. We lost our shirt on a house
Oh.
in Bridgeport, Connecticut. But everywhere else, we've done well. Okay, that's all. I mean, Bridgeport has gone so far left, it's left America, as Reagan would say. Same thing for California.
Yes.
But no, we're fine. We're set for retirement, and now it's a matter of trying to preserve what we have for legacy purposes, meaning family or charities or whatever else. But so I've enjoyed every job, but I enjoy public service the most because you can make a difference for your country and for others, and that's priceless.
So your book is coming out today. So tell me, what is the book about, and why should people not only read it if they're Americans, but have a global audience, and what could they learn? And so I don't want people to think about, oh, America, I'm going to tune it out. I think there are lessons you can learn in this that will also apply. So maybe you can be the superpower of your own economy, of your own life, of your own family.
Well, what's important is while it is focused primarily on America, it is not focused exclusively on America. It talks about the principles that it takes to become and stay a superpower. It learns lessons from history. It learns lessons from other countries. It ends up talking about the importance of alliances. It has specific reforms to put our finances in order and revitalize our economy. It has specific reforms to enhance our international relations and national security. It has specific reforms to deal with a lot of the other challenges that we face, such as immigration and border security and variety of those issues. And yeah, a lot of these issues are clearly transferable and scalable to others. You really don't know how well you're doing unless you know how you're doing it compared to plan. Are you getting better or worse trending? And then how do you compare to others? And unfortunately, in the United States, the assumption is since we're the largest economy based on nominal GDP, since we have the most powerful military, then we must be number one about everything. And the truth is, we're not. We're below average in a lot of things, including K through 12 education, including healthcare outcomes. And so, yeah, there are lessons here that go far beyond the shores of the United States, and that can be beneficial to others around the globe. And by the way, as you know, if America implodes, the world will feel it.
That is
And
true.
it will not be a positive event. And my objective is to make sure that never happens.
Name of the book again, so that everybody so it comes out of your mouth.
America in 2040, colon, still a superpower, question mark, a pathway to success.
That is David M. Walker, former U.S. Comptroller of the United States. I'd recommend everybody to pick up the book and pick up one as a gift for somebody else as well. And one of the ways I think I've achieved a lot of success in business is that, they were like, well, this is not business. It is business. It's fiscal responsibility. It's also basically getting into the mind of someone and how he thinks and how he's putting ideas together, because business is putting ideas together. Life is about putting ideas together and then presenting the ideas that you have in a way that other people will understand. And that's why I always tell people the art of conceptual implementation. You take other things from other concepts, other businesses, other ideas, other governments, other countries, and then you say, how does this apply to my life? And also, so when you meet people like Dave or other people, they'll be like, you know what? You can be educated rather than saying, I don't like the news. I don't care about this. I don't trust. You may not trust, but people sometimes are taking advantage because you're misinformed. And if you can inform yourself and you can see a better blueprint, I think it's going to sharpen your business acumen. I'd strongly recommend everyone to pick up that book. And I want to thank you, Dave, for being on. Fascinating interview. I think we could have gone 4 hours, and I'm sure we'll do part two, three, four. And if anything, if we can just impact the lives of a few people that will get it, but everyone has to do their part. Dave can only do so much. I can only do so much. You have to go out there and become uncomfortable. I'm going to give you the final word and also maybe your favorite quote.
Oh Lord, the final word. Thank you for the opportunity. The final quote is our best years are ahead of us if we put our mind to it and if we come together, not just for our country, but for our families.
Good point. Not only the minds, our hearts and souls, because it's not easy. It's all encompassing. Because if not, we're all screwed no
And
matter
I
what.
and the other thing I would say is JT, I'm a big TR fan, and his "In the Arena" quote is a great and very powerful quote where you have to be in the arena to really make a difference. And if you don't try, you'll never achieve anything. And it's much worse to never try than to try and not achieve what you're trying to achieve.
Well, for the record, if you were running for president, I would have voted for you. So just for the record, just if that we can keep that over, I like your no nonsense, easy way of approach and sense of fairness. And the truth is not always the most popular thing, but doing the right thing is. And that's what Dave represents. I want everybody, please share this podcast, share this video, like, comment, subscribe, do all you need to do, spread the word. Make sure you leave a comment as well, leave it a review. And, it's an interesting thing is if we all come together to try and find a common goal, and that's for a better future, that's the common goal. And it means different things for different people, but there are things if we don't do, it will never happen. And that's why everyone needs to pick up Dave M. Walker's book. Thank you so much, and we'll see you guys on the next show.
Take care, JT.